defend card.
May it please the court, counsel, my name is Dave Drew from Drew Law Firm in Blair, present on behalf of the appellant, Travis Swengard. This is an appeal from a first offense DUI conviction. The basis for the appeal really relates to a motion to suppress, so I'm going to focus on that. The facts on the motion to suppress were fairly undisputed. Mr. Swengard was placed under arrest. The breathalyzer for the Blair Police Department wasn't working, so the police officer, Officer Anderson, went and got a search warrant. Then she drew Mr. Swengard's blood, and our issue was that she did not provide a copy of the search warrant to Mr. Swengard prior to or after at any time when the blood was drawn. And that's the failure to give a copy. Number one was agreed to by all parties. That wasn't contested by the state. Number two, I believe it was even agreed to by the state that that was a violation of Section 29.815, which requires a police officer to give a defendant a copy of the search warrant.
Can I interrupt you right there?
Yeah.
By not giving him a copy, are you saying he didn't produce it and show that he had it, or just didn't leave a copy with him when he
didn't left? Produce it or show that she had it? She said, I'm going to go get it, then took him to the hospital. In the hospital room, you can hear her say the nurse, you can hear Officer Anderson tell the nurse, I've got a search warrant. And if you look at the video, you can kind of see the search warrant in Officer Anderson's folder. Draws the blood, then they go back. The search warrant never left Mr. and Mrs. Anderson's folder, is I believe what was agreed to. So it wasn't shown to him and it wasn't given to him. He was told, I'm going to go get it. And he was in the hospital room when Officer Anderson told the nurse, I've got a search warrant.
Is there anything that's unclear to your client as to what's happening in the hospital?
As to what's happening, no. He knew he was getting his blood drawn for a DUI.
And did he know that there was a search warrant that had been obtained to do that?
He was never told that it had been obtained. And frankly, I don't remember the precise...
Is he present when she tells the nurse that there's a search warrant?
In the same room, yes.
Okay.
When it was brought up months later, I think his testimony was, I don't honestly remember whether I heard that. Frankly, we didn't talk about it until a couple months
afterwards.
But
he knew why he was there at the
hospital. He knew why he was there. Okay. There's no...
Then I take it he did not ask to see a copy of the search warrant.
He didn't know that it had been issued. All he knew was she was going to go get it, and then, again, he might have overheard it in the hospital room. But no, he did not ask to see a copy. So
why was he agreeing to get his blood drawn then?
Well, you say agreeing. He was given the non-consent form. He knew he was under arrest for DUI. He would have had the right to say, I'm going to refuse this blood draw. He would have been charged with a different offense. Mm-hmm. But he would have had the right at that point to say, I don't want my blood drawn. And I believe he's got a constitutional right to refuse that and deal with the consequences of the refusal. By not being told there was a warrant or shown the warrant, that's where, if he's prejudiced, that's where he's prejudiced. To me, this case doesn't settle around prejudice because it's really the statutory violation is the simplest way. There's the two cases that we cite in our brief, Holman and Pearson, which say if there is a service violation, the remedy is suppression. I believe the county court, the district court, and the state are relying on the Knowles line cases, which say if it's a post-service violation, it's ministerial, so there's no suppression without prejudice. I think where the violation of the statute is at the time of service, which puts us in the category with Holman and Pearson, as opposed to the Knowles, where if this was after service,
well, the word service here kind of matters, right?
100%. Like, the timing and the word service and how that's defined is, in our case, it's the whole thing.
So is this, looking at the motion that was filed, the motion is framed in terms of rights under the Constitution of the United States and the state of Nebraska. But it seems to me that the violation that's being alleged is a statutory violation. Clearly, it's secondary to a Fourth Amendment search.
Correct.
But it's a statutory violation. So in other words, if that statute didn't exist, we wouldn't be here. Is that
correct?
Accurate?
Okay. I agree with that.
Okay.
Some cases are really complex, and we've heard some of those. As we're looking at it, there's the two Supreme Court cases that say service violations equal suppression. And I know that...
Isn't one of those Supreme Court cases a one-judge case?
It is.
So it is. Precedential or not?
You stumped me. I'll admit it.
I know it follows. I don't believe so.
Okay.
I mean, that's... If we do a one-judge opinion, I know for sure it's not precedential.
I'll be honest, it's cited in the reporter, so I figured it was. I have not done research as to whether it won justice. So don't hold me to anything.
Okay,
there.
All right.
I wanted to address the Knutson case cited by the state, where they cite the Knutson case, which says, absence of constitutional violation, a court will normally suppress evidence obtained in violation of a statute only if the governing law provides that remedy. And they cited it correctly. That's what it says. And I wanted to respond to that by saying, again, Holman and Pearson, if it's precedential, that's the established law. It's a pretty clear statement that says, if there's a service violation, then it equals suppression. And I would note that both Holman and Pearson, if precedential, are based on violation of statute and not constitutional violation.
And I want to take you back to something you said a few minutes ago. You said you don't see prejudice being a problem here. And I guess my question is, why not?
And I don't believe that we could prove prejudice to the level necessary to suppress it, which is why we didn't alleged as an appeal. His prejudice, if it is there, is he wouldn't be able to refuse the test. And I guess it would be a constitutional right that he's got notice to the warrant, unless there's one of the situations, what are they? there's a reasonable likelihood that evidence would be destruction or escalating the police encounter. To me, the purpose of those are clearly not applicable with what was happening with Mr. Swengard. He was cooperative and doing everything he was told. So,
do those circumstances of this search matter? I mean, in the typical search, searching a house.
Right.
The owner of the house is given a copy of the search warrant, so they know what the police have the authorization to search. And what they're searching for.
Correct.
Right. So that's the purpose. So people are on notice of what. Here, it doesn't seem like there's those issues are quite so much in play. Does it matter that the nature of this search is pretty obvious?
The nature is pretty obvious.
At the time it happens?
The Supreme Court case law requiring warrants to me is to protect the privacy, which is different than what you're describing, which is we're knocking houses, which is a dangerous situation. This really wasn't that. But the right of privacy is the same, and he's got a right to refuse it if he doesn't want his blood drawn, for sure.
Well, does he? Now that it's a search warrant, does he have a right to? He has a right to refuse. Under prior law, he had a right to refuse. If you get a search warrant, does he have a right to refuse a blood draw? You don't have a right to refuse a search.
Right.
And that was going to be my next question, is when he overheard the conversation in the room and the officer saying she had the search warrant, could he not have just said, I'd like to see it?
He could have. He probably should have. Well, and this kind of goes back to your question about, we want people under arrest to comply and be peaceful, right? And he was trying to do what he was told. He was being a model arrestee, if that's a term. And so he hears it, and in his mind, I think he was saying, you know, I need to be quiet and do what I'm told. And so he probably should have questioned it, looked at it, said, this isn't directed to an officer, and he could have maybe created some rights. Instead, I think he was trying to be
cooperative.
Right. Okay. And so I hate for him to be punished and lose rights because he's going out of his way to be cooperative.
Okay.
So, all right. Thank you, Mr. Drew. Thank you very much. And how much did we go over?
38 seconds.
All right. Please add that to Mr. List's time.
My guess is Mr. List is not going to need an additional.
He's pretty quick.
I just have this feeling.
I hope not, and if I do, something tells me I'm in trouble. Good morning, Mr. Drew. My pleas to the court, Nathan List, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the Appalachian State of Nebraska. We maintain that Mr. Spengard's motion to suppress was properly denied, as noted in our brief, and again here today. Our case law provides that in the absence of a constitutional violation, a court will normally suppress evidence obtained in violation of a rule or statute only if the governing law provides that remedy. The statute in question here, 29-815, does not say or suggest that failure to provide someone with a copy of a warrant or the inventory is grounds for suppression, and none of our other statutes provide that suppression would apply here either. To the contrary, 29-823, as well as our case law, provide that no evidence shall be suppressed because of technical irregularities not affecting the substantial rights of the accused. Here, as the record reflects, the error in question did not affect Mr. Spengard's substantial rights. The failure to strictly comply with 29-815 had no bearing on the validity of the search warrant or the search itself. Plus, 29-815 itself provides that upon request, the court or magistrate shall provide a copy of the search warrant inventory to the person from whom the property was taken, so that information was readily available to Mr. Spengard, regardless of whether it was provided by law enforcement.
Would he have had a right to refuse the blood draw, notwithstanding the warrant?
In light of a warrant being obtained, no, he would not. Under Birchfield, prior to a warrant being obtained,
right,
he would. Yes.
So, in your opinion, then there's no prejudice here, correct?
No. I mean, when I read Knutson and the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Sanchez and Almas, I don't know that we get into prejudice because as I'm reading those decisions, they're saying that if the state law or the rule in question isn't expressly providing remedy as or suppression as a remedy, it's not available. And so we don't get into prejudice, lack of prejudice. Is it pre-service, during service, post-service, any of that? To me, the statute has to provide suppression as a remedy or it's not available. But to the extent that we would be looking at,
In Holman and Pearson, was there any statutory, there's no statutory remedy for suppression. Is that not created by the Supreme Court?
That's true. First, with respect to Pearson, I would note that while it did point to the statute, it also pointed to federal constitutional law with respect to the requirements of knocking and announcement and all of that. So there was constitutional implications at play there, and they were sort of intermingled with respect to the conclusion that we have a violation of the knock and announce requirement here, so we're going to find that suppression is warranted. But nonetheless, in both Pearson and Holman, to the extent that they did point to state law in finding that justified suppression. I guess my main point would be that those predated Knutson and the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Sanchez Llamas. So we didn't have law at the time saying that, you know, in order for suppression to be warranted for a violation of a rule or state statute, that it would have to be provided for by that governing law. That came afterward. In 2006 was Sanchez Llamas, and then Knutson, of course, in 2014, which was based on Sanchez Llamas. So I, with those cases predating those decisions, I think that's certainly material and would explain why they wouldn't have gone there. And I would also note that with respect to the statute in question, 29-815, it was amended after Knutson, and there was nothing inserted into that statute, which provides for suppression as a remedy in the event that any of those provisions are violated. I don't really have anything else to add. I think I've now hit all the points I was going
to. So I got to get some clarity in my own mind here. So we have Nolte, Holman, Pearson that talk about a standard to apply. And they've used this word, if there's a service-related error, then there's exclusion, right? And so we're focusing on what service means, right? But then we separately have 29823 that talks about its technical irregularities. And so do we apply both rules here? Do we look at the jurisprudence as it relates to, you know, when we have a constitutional issue at stake, Fourth Amendment right is protected. Do we have to first look to see whether there's a service issue and then look to the statute? Are they saying the same thing? Where do we go with this?
Well, that's a good question, and I've asked myself that as I was briefing this and preparing for oral argument. I don't know that I have a great answer. I guess what I have come up with is the fact that, especially when I look at the law you're citing or you're referring to with Nolte and all of that about you know, errors that occur in violation of statute with post-service, the original decisions with that, you know, those go back also prior to Knutson and all in those decisions. So,
but Nolte's after Knutson.
It is. It is. But I think because that's the exact nature of the error in question, that language has just sort of carried through. And so I'm not sure that is inconsistent with Knutson. I think that language and that analysis just is directly on point. And because Nolte was the exact same situation as Hinton and McCown, where you had the failure to return the warrant in 10 days. All three of those cases are the exact same thing. And so Nolte was just one more of the same, and I think that's probably why that language and that analysis.
Let me suggest another distinction to you. In Knutson, you didn't have a constitutional issue at stake because the court found there was no right to privacy with respect to the phone. So they said, we're only dealing with statutory violation. However, in Nolte, in Pearson, and Holman, all of them had a constitutional issue at stake. There was a right to privacy impacted. So they're analyzing the case in that regard. Does that make sense?
It does, but at least in Holman, I don't know that they went into really a right of privacy. I thought that was pretty much just statutory. But, no, I mean, yeah, that makes sense. I would agree with that.
So if there's a constitutional issue at stake, under the current law at least, we still have to do a Nolte analysis, meaning we have to still look at that language the Supreme Court used in that regard as it relates to, is this a service error? And then separately, we have to look at the statute, I guess, as it relates to the irregularity language there that affects a substantial right. In other words, it looks like there's two layers here when there's a constitutional issue at stake. That's a question. Do you agree or disagree with that?
Potentially. you know, I don't know that you need to answer that question since we clearly don't have a constitutional question that's been presented. But yes, I mean, to an extent, yes, I would agree with that, because if you're getting into the constitutional realm, then you're necessarily going to be looking into whether an expectation of privacy is at issue and whether that's been infringed, et cetera, et cetera. And so, you know, that analysis could be relevant in that regard. But nonetheless, to me, at the end of the day here, we're still looking at Knutson and Sanchez-Llamas and the fact that if we're talking about purely a violation or alleged violation of state statute, expression as a remedy has to be set forth in that statute for it to be available. And I don't think that we need to even get into the Nolte lines of cases or any other lines of cases if that's the issue.
Do you think there's a distinction between, I mean, we're talking about whether there's a constitutional issue here. It seems to me maybe it's better characterized if whether there's an underlying constitutional right involved, because I think even Mr. Drew agreed that we're dealing with a state statute, a statutory violation, and we wouldn't be here if that statute didn't exist, because there's no underlying Fourth Amendment issue here. I mean, it's a search, so that implicates the Fourth Amendment. But that's not what's being complained of, is that there's no probable cause for the search. We're dealing with how the search is conducted. And so, but is there a distinction between the Knutson case, which doesn't seem to even have the underlying constitutional issue, and a case like this that does have an underlying constitutional search? That seems to me like in Pearson, or Holman, maybe more accurately, that's important to the court, you know, and so that, so they're going to hold the line on nighttime searches. So how does that interplay?
Well, again, I'm not sure that we have a clean or clear answer. I'm trying to sort through this just as you are, and I have been for the last day, and I obviously don't have perfect answers. But I mean, yeah, obviously, if you have constitutional principles at play, the analysis changes, and I guess, you know, perhaps that might be when we would potentially be looking beyond purely Knutson and saying, well, okay, if we have, you know, constitutional implications here, or then we need to look at prejudice, or is a substantial right affected, et cetera, and that's when we would get into that versus just saying categorically, well, under Knutson, if there's no express language that provides for suppression, we're done here altogether, period. But I'm not entirely sure, and I would say with certainty that we don't pinpoint the time of service, as the appellant is suggesting, because none of these decisions have focused on the timing of service or the manner of service, and...
That leads to another question that I meant to ask Mr. Drew and didn't get up, so I'll go ahead and ask you. If we're back to where we're contrasting this search with the search of a house, if the owner of the house is not home, the officer doesn't have to go find him. So they don't have to give him prior service of the warrant. Is that, that would be correct, I believe.
Correct.
But they would have to leave a copy of the warrant behind, as if I'm remembering the statute correctly. And so I think that brings us back to, is it that important under Nolte whether this is a service or a post-service issue, or is it really come down to the whether it's a ministerial issue or a substantive issue, is more the case in Holman?
I think so, yes. I mean, I think to the extent we're looking at this and applying analysis, it's more a matter of, does this matter? I mean, does this affect anything, you know?
Then we're getting to prejudice, right? Aren't we just saying, doesn't that just come right around back to, was he prejudiced by this?
It might. I mean, I guess my first position was I don't know that we get there, but alternatively, to the extent we do, it's our position that a substantial right here is affected and we don't have any prejudice, you know, for all the reasons that you discussed with Mr. Drew during his argument. I'm not going to rehash all that, but in light of the circumstances of this case, we would submit there certainly was no prejudice and a substantial right was not affected. He clearly knew what was going on. This wasn't a search of a house where he might not know what they're seeking and what they're taking and what they have taken. And want to know what that inventory was afterward. I mean, it clearly isn't what we're dealing with.
Right.
I think the more interesting question, and one, again, I don't have a good answer to, is do we even get into this analysis, or does it truly end with Knutson and Sanchez Llamas, that just categorically, if the statute hasn't provided suppression as a remedy, that is the end of analysis, period. Again, I've done my best to help. I don't have a clear answer myself.
Thank you, Mr. List. So we are going to let the record reflect that we actually took Mr. List over his time.
Yes, let it be noted.
So we'll put thank that you. On the and calendar. Since we did go over, how much over did we go?
1:47.
Mr. Drew, do you have any final word you'd like to give us?
I guess, one, this feels like it should be a constitutional case. It feels like a Fourth Amendment case. The Chapter 8 of 29 is search and seizure, but the law as presented is all statutory on this specific service issue that we were able to identify. And there aren't any good what service, what's the process necessary for a DUI blood draw, which I agree with you, it's a different thing, and so we're trying to compare apples and oranges. And so all your questions are great. I don't have a lot of great answers. Apparently set a record getting Mr. List over 10 minutes, so I feel great about that.
We did.
All right, thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, the case will be taken under submission and counsel are excused.